Accession number 20362, Reel 1.
Charles Poulter, Reel 1. Where were you born, please?
47 Mabley Street, Hackney, London, E9.
Which year was this?
1923.
Did you grow up and have your schooling in Hackney?
Yes.
Where did you go to school?
Berger Road School, Hackney.
How old were you when you finished there?
14 years old.
So that must have been in 36?
37.
Did you get a job?
Yes.
Doing?
I was apprentice at wood machinery in the furniture trade.
Is that what you were doing when war was declared?
Yes.
Had you joined TM before the war?
No.
Did you hear Neville Chamberlain declare war on Germany?
I did, yes.
Under what circumstances?
I just listened to the radio at home, and that was a reaction. It was just a shock reaction to everybody around.
Had you not expected it?
Yes, really, really, yes.
Did the war affect you at first?
Not really affected me, although I came from a large family, and I had elder brothers, and I knew that they would be called into the forces before me.
Were you in the London Blitz?
Yes.
Can you give details of what you remember about that personally, please?
Yes, we lived in we had moved from Mabley Street in Hackney to the Leighton area, Huxley Road, Leighton. And in the bottom of the garden, we had two Anderson air raid shelters. And when the air raids came on in London, especially when the bombing of the docks, we went into the air raid shelter, and the house opposite, the other side of the road, had an oil bomb dropped on there, which caught the house and our roof alight, which we had to, which a couple of my brothers and the owner of the house next door, we had to put out. And that was the main thing of the bombs and the incendiary bombs that were dropping in the area, because Leighton wasn't very far from the docks at West Ham, and so and the railways, of course. So this was the centre of the bombing attacks on the east end of London.
How did you go about trying to put out the fire from the oil bomb?
We connected a hose to a tap, which in this house didn't have an outside tap. It came from the bathroom. And we did that. And we used to have, on the front of each house, we used to have filled sandbags. And so the sandbags came very useful as well in throwing the sand onto the centre of the fire. But we managed to get rid of the flames without calling the fire brigade by both of us using a hose on the roof. And lucky enough, the flames didn't reach the loft of the house. We managed to get rid of the flames caused by the oil on the slates of the roof.
What kind of oil was it?
That I don't know. It was just classed as an oil bomb that they used to drop them, that used to throw the flames within a distance of 10 or 20 yards.
Was it like petrol?
Yeah, petrol. I would think there must have been then some inflammatory device in there, but what it consisted of, I don't really know.
Do Did you see many casualties from the bombing?
Yes, we had quite a large area which was bombed, especially in the in Leighton Green, where they had quite a large public underground shelter, and unfortunately one bomb did drop in the entrance of the shelter, and that caused quite a lot of casualties. As a matter of fact, at the time you just went into the nearest shelter wherever you was, and my brother-in-law, he was actually in the shelter, and he managed to get out of the shelter, and he partly had lost a memory, which we had to sort of skirt the streets, around the streets to find him. Lucky enough, we found him wandering around. But as regards the family itself, we had no casualties. He was the one that got the shot from the Leighton Green bombing of the public shelter.
How did the bombing affect morale?
Oh, not very much at all. Not very much, because it was amazing the way everybody helped one another out wherever it was. Neighbours, for instance, you were all one, and if anybody had any problems, well then everybody helped you out. So it was a tremendous atmosphere amongst everybody, tremendous atmosphere. And that kept the morale up, I think.
What was the attitude towards the German air crews who were carrying out the bombing?
Well, we never, apart from seeing the dogfights between the German aircraft, the Spitfires and the Hurricanes overhead, as I said, we were right near the docks, London docks. Apart from that, we didn't have any aircraft drop anywhere near us, but I suppose really the various reports that you got in the newspapers, you weren't very happy with German aircraft, airmen, or anything involved in the German army. It's just one of those things that you accepted, because you knew that your own family had to go and join up in the forces.
Did you listen to radio in those days?
Oh yes, listen to radio. Listen to all, mainly the news. And of course the main entertainment was of course the various big bands that used to play music on the radio, which used to keep everybody sort of going, you know. It was, the atmosphere was very, very good under the circumstances.
Did you listen to Churchill's speeches?
Yes, did listen. Yeah, listen to it. Everything political, everything involved in broadcasts from Herbert Morrison, who was Deputy Prime Minister then, and Churchill, you know, it all went down, and I think they were the people that really kept the morale of everybody up.
Did you think the Germans might win the war?
Well, I think after Dunkirk, I thought that there could have been an invasion at any time. And these speeches that Churchill were given was just keeping everybody going and keeping the morale of everybody up. And it was just a matter of waiting just to see what was going to happen.
Did you listen to Haw Haw?
We used to, at first we used to listen, and then immediately my mother used to say, off, switch it off, so off it went.
What effect did his speeches have?
Nothing at all. Just people treated Haw Haw as a traitor.
Can you tell me about joining up yourself, please?
Yes, I received my call-up papers. I went for a medical first of all, and passed A1, And then I received my call up to join the forces on September the 30th, 1942, where I had to report to Bury St Edmunds in Suffolk, to the Suffolk Regiment, for basic training.
What was your basic training like?
It was 6 weeks of basic training, and that was involved intelligence tests, just to find out which branch of the forces of the army that you could, which would suit you better, and that involved in writing tests, intelligence tests, English, history, just to get a general picture of what you like to do. And then at the end of that period of training, you went before a board of officers, and they had the results of your training in front of them. And they said to me, what would you like to do in the army? And I said, well, I've always been interested in radio, and I would like to join the Royal Corps of Signals. And they had a little chat between themselves, and they said, well, with the intelligence reports that we've got from you, that we think that you'd be better off in the Royal Tank Regiment. And they've got radio there, so you could go as a wireless operator. From then onwards, I was posted to the RAC, Royal Armoured Corps Training Regiment at Catterick in Yorkshire. Again, for 6 weeks basic training. That training consisted of 2 weeks driving, another, and then tests, examinations through that. 2 weeks as gunnery, where you was trained in operating all guns in that was involved in tanks. And 2 weeks as wireless operator. And then from then onwards, again, you went through exactly the same procedure with facing the committee of officers, and they looked at your report, and they said, by looking at your report, we think that you could be suited better in the tank regiment as a gunner wireless operator. Yes, as I said, we went before the panel of officers, and they looked at the various the tests and the examinations that you had on the three subjects of driving, wireless operating and gunnery, and said that we think that you would be better posted to a Royal Tank Regiment as a gunner wireless operator. Orders went up a couple of weeks after that, and I was then posted just myself, just of the group in the Nissenhut. I was posted on my own to the 9th Royal Tank Regiment, which were based at Charing in Kent. I made myself way down there to Kent by train, and I was met at Charing Station by a 1500 weight. And the person in driving said, I'm taking you to C Squadron at Royal Tank Regiment at Hall's Place in Charing. And we went there. And the area was way in the middle of a forest where we just had a couple of Nissen huts. No electricity, no heating facilities at all, and that's where we were operated from then on. The shower consisted of just an ordinary empty 5 gallon can of petrol, which had holes in the bottom, which water was heated up and poured in the top, which somebody did, and you were underneath. And then you, when that was finished and you had your shower, you had to sign the you had to sign the book to say that you've had a shower. Very primitive, the way that we lived. And each day we were taken to the tank park, where the tanks were in bays, hidden under the trees. And I found out then that I was going to be a tank crew of a Churchill tank.
How did you feel about that?
It didn't bother me at all, because the group, the people that I'd met with, they were just as one person. Everybody helped everybody else. And then I was found that when I went to Sea Squadron, I was posted to 12 Troop. And 12 Troop consisted of three Churchill tanks. Troop Officer's Tank, which consisted of the Troop Officer and four crew. Troop Sergeant's Tank, which consisted of the Troop Sergeant and four crew. And a Troop Corporal's Tank, which the same was a Troop Corporal and four in the crew. And I was I was to be the gunner on the Troop Leader's Tank, which was Lieutenant Frank Drew.
Where did he come from?
He had been posted from the Middle East. I believe it was from the 8th Royal Tank Regiment, and he had been posted back from the Middle East to this country, to the 9th Battalion, where they wanted to intermix one or two experienced officers back with people that had been called up from Civvy Street in this country. And he was an asset. He named each one of the tanks in the 9th Battalion started with the letter I. 12 Troop, the troop officer had the job of naming our three tanks. He named one tank Ibn El Kelb, which was in English was a son of a bee. The other tank he named as Ibn Sword, which was the was a king. And the other one he named as Infamous, which was just an ordinary English word, Infamous. That was our three tank names. And we trained together then from... I joined Sea Squadron in March 1943, and we stayed together then until the embarkation to Normandy from Gosport.
Which tank did you become crew of?
I became crew of the Troop Leader's Tank, which was called Ibn El Kelb.
Can you tell me about the preparations for D-Day, please?
It was constantly training all the time. We travelled to Eastwell Park, which was a local park near us. It was sealed off, and that was used for various exercises. We went to various gunnery places so that we could fire guns. We went to Lydd in Sussex, which we fired into the sea. We went up to Kirkcudbright in Scotland, which again that we fired into the hills there. And in general, I was mainly involved in wireless operating and gunnery, but mainly on gunnery. And that was basically our training. We went to the South Downs and trained in the South Downs, living under the conditions that we knew that we'd live under in Normandy, because we knew, we didn't know Normandy then, but we knew it would be France. And it was just constantly training, mixing. Each tank prepared their own food. We lived on our own. Five people lived together all the time as one. We knew one another. We couldn't know one another any better than we did. We helped one another. Anybody had a problem in a tank anywhere, the radio or the gunnery or whatever, we was there to help. Because everybody in the tank had to do two jobs. There was the tank commander, which was normally trained for either job. You had the gunner operator on the main gun. You had a driver operator or a gunner operator in the turret. The driver was a driver mechanic. The co-driver was a gunner mechanic. And so the gunner was trained to drive. The gunner mechanic was trained to drive. The driver operator could take over the driving of the tank if possible. If it wasn't a driver operator in the turret, there were two gunner operators. So the gunner could take the place of an operator and vice versa. And that's how we worked, and we switched and changed, and until we found out the most suitable place, until our tank commander, and as I said, or the troop leader, which was Lieutenant Frank Drew, found the right positions for everybody to be in, and that's how we settled. And we just trained all the time, and it was constantly stripping guns down, putting them back together, so that we could do it in the quickest possible time. For when it came to, that's what we could do. We just had, the whole tank was covered round with shells, which was an armour-piercing shell for the main 75mm gun, high-explosive shells, which was a 75mm as well, the 303 belted ammunition, which went into the heavy machine gun, which was fed through the centre of the gun from the operator through to the gunner, which he fed into the belt, into the main machine gun. We had a mounted operated Bren gun in the turret, which we carried a 100 round magazine for fighting against low flying aircraft. We had each member of the crew was issued with a revolver, which was strapped to your waist. We had Sten guns in there in case we went out and could take a Sten gun with us. We had incendiary shells at the side of us, six on each side, which if we had infantry getting too close to us, which we could just throw out the side to keep them away, because our vision was lost if somebody came too close to us. So we had these as protection to throw out protect the crew so they couldn't get too near us. That's the main sort of armament that we had in the tank. We had various procedures to carry out, and not everything went smoothly. If the operator used to load the guns, which put in the armour piercing or the high explosive 75mm shell, and sometimes we had a misfire. And if you had a misfire, you had a procedure which told you exactly what to do. You left the shell in there for 1 minute. The operator by the main big gun reset the firing pin by hand, manually. You wait in another minute and the gunner fired again. When, if there was no response, you waited another minute, that's 3 minutes all told. If there was nothing coming from that, the operator had to open up the breech by hand as quickly as he possibly could, reject the shell, pass it through to the tank commander, and he disposed of it through the hatch. That was the way that we had to quickly get rid of misfires, because they could go off at any time, you know, in the tank. So they had to be got rid of quickly. Anything connected with misfiring with a machine gun, that was at the shoulder of the gunner, in the turret, and he's the one that had to find out the fault and repair it as quickly as possible to get the gun back firing again. And that was the procedure where everybody helped one another, you know, in the tank. The gunner had a remote control which he could traverse the gun. The gun, which when you travel, was at 12 o'clock, which was over the top of the driver and the co-driver. But the tank commander used to issue through the intercom the procedure of where he saw the enemy, wherever it may be. And he could give his instructions to the gunner, traverse left or traverse right, slow down, and then when the gunner could pick up the enemy in the his telescope, which was a magnified telescope, the tank commander gave the distance, and the gunner then fired 200 yards, 300 yards, whatever it may be. And when the first shot landed, the tank commander could give the issue up 100, down 50, whatever it may be, and the graduated marks on the telescope, the gunner automatically operated to his command and fired until the target was hit. And then, of course, while this was going on, the commander then was looking at anything else that was within range of the target, and then you were traversed round, whichever it may be. Sometimes, to help the tank commander, the gunner could traverse in his own free will, so that he could see anything away from where the commander was looking. And then over the intercom, he could say to the crew, you know, I've spotted whatever. And this, the way that it worked in action, you know. So that was the procedure of the tank crews in a Churchill tank.
What happened to you next in the sequence of events?
What, as regards...
You were talking about the various places you went to for preparation for going across.
Oh, yes, yes. Well, from then onwards, we used to do guard duty and, you know, on the tanks. But it was mainly being together. After training, being together. Going, travelling, if you had a vehicle going into the nearest town, which was either Faversham or Canterbury in our case, we all went together and we all enjoyed ourselves the best way that we could. Because it was training all the time.
Can you take me through the procedure for actually embarking and going across, please?
Yes, we left Charing in the tanks. We left on the 6th of June. We went to down to Ash near Aldershot. And it was there onwards that we had to waterproof the tanks, and each crew were responsible for waterproofing the tanks in certain stages. You had to waterproof up to 2 feet from the base of the ground level to 2 feet, and waterproof anything with Bostik or any with the materials that you were supplied with. And then when you felt that you'd sealed it sufficiently, this was the job of all the crew. We drove down to a particular tank, and the tank was just under 2 foot deep, and we drove through that, and from then we could see whether there was any water leaking or anything. If there was, we resealed. If there wasn't, you carried on sealing again from 2 feet up then to 4 feet. And then when you had sealed that, you did the same procedure. You went into a deeper tank and you drove the tank through and you checked the tank there. Then you went, carried that on until we reached right to the turret at the top of the tank. The gun itself, the main gun and the machine gun, was covered with a balloon barrage, a balloon